This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's radio.
Free
radio.
Hello and welcome to This Week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, as well as on the Rabble Podcast Network and online on iTunes. We're an independent Canadian and global news and culture hour featuring the best interviews, headlines, and music from this week's Media Morning Show every day on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. And you can find our podcast links and headlines and more at w2media.ca. Here at This Week on Media Mornings, we try to make some sense of this week's headlines, bringing you news, perspectives, and culture you won't hear anywhere else. I'm David Ball, your host for This Week. Now, on today's program, we're very excited to speak with Bob Rae, former Member of Parliament, longtime Member of Parliament, as well as former Ontario Premier and leader of the Federal Liberal Party, about his decision to step down from politics and focus on negotiations on behalf of 9 First Nations in Northern Ontario over the Ring of Fire, a giant mining complex roughly the size of France. We'll also hear from Eugene Bellanger, Director of Strategic Planning for Dashinta. It's a land-based Indigenous school in the far north. And Keith Stewart, Greenpeace Canada's Climate and Energy Coordinator, will talk about last weekend's tar sands healing walk, as well as the train oil disaster in Lac Mégantic, Quebec, and the future of fossil fuels.
And finally, Tai'i journalist Crawford Killian will speak about Corporal Horton. He is the RCMP investigator who filed quite shocking court documents alleging fraud and other crimes by Senator Duffy and linking the Prime Minister's office. We get more details on what the RCMP is investigating with the Senate scandal.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independent like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maud Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at w2media.com.
And we'll be right back with this week's top news headlines. And in our top story this week, the head of the railway company behind the massive oil train explosion in Lac Mégantic, Quebec, told the media the company has suspended engineer Tom Harding, who left the train track unattended. Train unattended on the tracks near Nantes, Quebec, suggesting he did not set the handbrakes properly. But in the aftermath of the oil disaster, which leveled the heart of the small town and has so far claimed 20 lives, though at least 60 remain missing, officials have revealed that the rail company, whose 73-car train devastated the Quebec town, had convinced the federal government last year that it could safely operate trains with a single engineer only on board. According to the Toronto Star, Montreal Main and Atlantic Railway, MMA, got the green light from Transport Canada to reduce staffing in 2012. Senior Transport Canada officials acknowledge that MMA is only one of two companies in the entire country allowed to operate with only a single employee on a train. The other company is Quebec North Shore and Labrador Railway. The government also said it is very unusual, though not against the rules, for a company to leave the train unattended at night on the main rail line, as happened last Friday before the train got loosed and careened into Lac Mégantic. Much of the village was destroyed when cars carrying crude oil derailed and blew up, leaving at least 20 dead and dozens of people missing. On Friday night, the sole engineer of MMA's ill-fated train parked it in nearby Nantes, Quebec, before heading off to sleep for the night. But despite the head of MMA yesterday apologizing to residents and claiming that his company has a good safety record prior to the disaster, the Toronto Star has learned that the railway operator in fact had an accident rate far higher than average in the United States over the last decade. Statistics show that from 2003 until 2012, MMA had an average rate of 38.8 accidents and incidents per million track miles traveled, which is more than double national average rate of 17.15 over the same decade. MMA's poor record looks even worse in other categories over the same period. In terms of train accidents per million track miles, a statistic that excludes incidents such as hazardous material leaks, MMA's rate of 11.87 is more than three times the national American average of 3.36. Here's a clip of the CEO of MMA apologizing to residents in the Quebec town.
We are making an abject apology to the people in this town. It has my utmost sympathy, and personally, I'm devastated by what happened here. I would feel the same way if something like this happened in my community.
And that was the CEO of MMA Railway speaking in Lac Mégantic yesterday as members of the community heckled him. Now in Indigenous news, a leader of a nascent First Nations alliance set to challenge the Assembly of First Nations Authority has issued a sharp warning in advance of parallel meetings to be held by both groups next week. The National Post reports that Manitoba Grand Chief Derek Nepenak has told AFN that Chief Sean Adlio that his province's chiefs are unanimously opposed to the AFN's dealings with the Harper government when it comes to treaties. Nepenak has also been a leading advocate for a new national treaty alliance, arguing the Ottawa-based AFN has made little progress pressuring the federal government into honoring treaties signed long ago between First Nations and the Crown. The meeting is the same week as AFN's annual General Assembly, meaning some chiefs will have to choose which to attend. Now, the lawyer for one of two Surrey, BC residents accused of planning to bomb the province's legislature on Canada Day says the case has elements of entrapment by police. John Nuttall and Amanda Carity were charged earlier this month with knowingly facilitating a terrorist activity, making or possessing an explosive device, and conspiracy to place an explosive device with the intent to cause death or injury. Court documents show Carity and Nuttall are each facing an additional charge of conspiracy to murder persons unknown. The two briefly appeared in court on Tuesday morning as provincial court charges against the pair were stayed so the case could move to BC Supreme Court for a direct indictment. Speaking outside the courtroom, Nuttall's lawyer, Tom Marino, alluded to U.S. police forces being involved in the investigation but said it could be tough to prove whether the police, in fact, set a trap for the pair. Nuttall and Carity, who are alleged to have turned ordinary pressure cookers into improvised explosive devices, were claimed by police to have been inspired by Al-Qaeda ideology, but said there is no evidence the two were acting at the direction of any terror group. However, the couple's friends have said they find it hard to believe the pair could have organized such a plot. The couple's landlord described them as having limited means and questioned how they could have financed such a plot, and there have been implications that the police may have used a Mr. Big-style strategy where they convinced two unwitting people to participate in a plot that they wouldn't have otherwise engaged in. And on tomorrow's program, we'll speak with the campaign director for the BC Civil Liberties Association about why they're concerned about this case. Now, as Toronto began to mop up after a massive storm that deluged roads and halted the city's transit system, Mayor Rob Ford and council colleagues Doug Holliday and Peter Milson were both contesting the Etobicoke Lakeshore seat at Queen's Park, headed out Tuesday to examine some of the hardest hit areas. According to the National Post, Ford made three stops, all in the mayor's home turf of Etobicoke. Toronto Mayor Rob Ford applauded officials as satisfactory response to one of the worst storms in the city's history, but pleaded with citizens to conserve power because the hydro system is hanging by a thread right now. Ford called for a complete review of how the city handles emergency situations, according to the Toronto Star, saying that some areas of Monday's storm response needed improvement. But meanwhile, the Star reports that the catastrophic storm earlier this week is likely to lead to much higher insurance premiums for homeowners next year, a leading credit rating agency has predicted. Although reeling from the massive flooding in Calgary on June 20th, some of Canada's largest property insurance firm will be hit hard by Monday night's deluge, which caused an estimated $600 million in damage, the biggest single torrential downpour in the city's history. Meanwhile, Inside Toronto reports that the question of how to improve the city's infrastructure is a pressing one. According to a study commissioned by the city on climate change, Monday's storm is somewhat ahead of schedule in terms of intensity. Toronto Environmental Alliance Director Franz Hartman pointed out the storm delivered just over two-thirds the amount of rainfall expected by a more typical by 2040, according to climate change models. Hartman added that it is 65% of what climate change models predict. And to say at the least, he said, we are not prepared. Mayor Ford, meanwhile, insisted, quote, no one can predict what Mother Nature's up to, but it seems to me we're getting more rain. This is not the time to get into politics, he added. Now, in other Toronto news, the Board of Health voted 6-2 on Wednesday to ask the provincial government to open a supervised injection facility for the city's drug users, a landmark proposal promptly dismissed by the province. The Toronto Star reports that the Conservative federal government is opposed to such facilities aimed at harm reduction, which allow addicts to inject illegal drugs using clean equipment under the supervision of nurses, as has been pioneered in Vancouver's downtown east side. Both Police Chief Bill Blair and Mayor Rob Ford are also opposed. David McKeown, the city's chief medical officer, is strongly in favor. The board heard on Wednesday from unanimous parade of doctors, harm reduction workers, academic experts, and drug users themselves that the facilities prevent deadly overdoses, reduce healthcare costs, and help connect addicts with services they need to improve their lives. The Supreme Court ruled in 2011 that the federal government must allow a Vancouver facility Insight to continue operating. Chief Justice McLachlan, writing for the 9-0 court ruling, said that Insight has been proven to save lives with no discernible negative impact, but the government responded with legislation, almost not yet passed, that would make it even more difficult for applicants to obtain the required exemptions from drug laws. Now in northern Alberta, mysterious oily sheen on the Athabasca River appears to be spreading and has reached the shores of Fort Chippewa. Residents report finding dead fish in the affected area, and the town's water intake is now closed. The sheen is visible along more than 100 kilometers of the Athabasca River, sometimes covering the water from shore to shore. Alberta government officials are trying to determine its source. They say that no energy companies have reported releases, and they suggest the sheen is probably from natural bitumen deposits. The apparent pollution comes only 2 weeks after an oil spill occurred at the Canadian Natural Resources Primrose operations on June 24th. According to Huffington Post, the spill happened on Cold Lake Air Weapons Range inside the traditional hunting territories of Beaver Lake Cree Nation. Members of that band were told by cleanup sources that the spill site, that the damage was described as black puddles or black spots coming up in different areas from underground. Now in other Alberta news, a University of Alberta professor involved in developing a successful anti-rape campaign has said that a parody poster campaign suggesting that most women lie about being raped is offensive and also likely violates copyright rules. The Edmonton Journal reports that the posters put up around the University of Alberta campus and possibly downtown this week use images from the Don't Be That Guy campaign and change the text to send the opposite message. Canada already has low reporting rates and low conviction rates for the crime. Most previous campaigns to fight sexual assault focused on prevention tips for women, and the SAVE campaign was designed to focus its message on perpetrators. Now down to U.S. news, where the Texas House has approved new abortion limits in a second special session, less than 2 weeks after Senate Republicans failed to finish work on the bill amid a filibuster and raucous protests. The Associated Press reports that Republicans rejected every attempt to amend the bill. Throngs of protesters were missing for Wednesday's mostly procedural vote after days of protests by supporters and opponents. The bill only allow abortions in surgical centers and ban abortions after 20 weeks, which would effectively close almost all of the state's abortion clinics. Democrats and women's rights activists have protested the bill for weeks. The measure died after a 13-hour filibuster by State Senator Wendy Davis. In NSA surveillance whistleblower news, Edward Snowden, the fugitive American intelligence contractor, is meeting with representatives of international human rights organizations at the airport, breaking silence after spending nearly 3 weeks in the airport's transit zone. Snowden's leaks have led to revelations that the U.S. is systematically seizing vast amounts of phone and web data from hundreds of millions of Americans as well as non-citizens under the NSA program known as PRISM. It has led to increased tensions with European and Latin American allies who have been shown information that they were spied on as well, including wiretapping of the United Nations Secretary General's home as well as offices of allied governments such as Germany, France, and Italy. Now in Brazil, tens of thousands of workers across the country have walked off their jobs and taken to the streets in a peaceful nationwide strike, demanding better working conditions and improved public services in Latin America's biggest nation. Metal workers, transportation and construction workers, and civil servants adhered to a day of struggle organized by the country's five leading labor federations. The strikers are also demanding better public transit, health, and education services. It follows mass nationwide protests that swept Brazil last month when demonstrators, angered with corruption, poor public services, and a heavy tax burden, took to the streets. And in UK news, a team of six environmental campaigners scaled the tallest building in Europe, the 310-meter glass tower above London Bridge, to draw attention to Shell's oil and glass drilling plans in the Arctic. The Shard building saw activists unfurl the Save the Arctic banner to cheers from supporters below. The women then made their way inside the building. Scotland Yard said all six protesters had been arrested on suspicion of aggravated protest. In Japan, the country may restart several nuclear reactors shut down by the Fukushima crisis and earthquake in about a year, a senior regulator said in an interview. But as Reuters reports, at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant north of Tokyo, the site of the world's worst atomic disaster since Chernobyl in 1986, the situation took a turn for the worse as radiation levels in groundwater soared, suggesting highly toxic materials from the plant are now close to the Pacific Ocean. But Japan is forging ahead with attempts to restart the idle reactors in the face of a skeptical public. Tokyo Electric Power Company, the operator of Fukushima, hit by a 2011 earthquake and tsunami, said the observation well between damaged reactor number 2 and the sea showed levels of radioactive cesium were 90 times higher on Monday than they had been last Friday. It also detected cesium-134 at 150 times above Japan's safety standard. And our final story today, in Egypt, The Guardian reports that the political crisis shows no signs of abating as the military-backed authorities move against defiant Islamist supporters of the deposed president, Mohamed Morsi. Wrangling continues over a new government, casting a pall over the start of Ramadan holiday. The Guardian reports that public prosecutors ordered the arrest of Mohamed Badi, the supreme guide of Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood, over accusations of inciting violence on Monday outside a Republican Guard headquarters, where 51 people were killed in the country's worst single incident in over a year. Half a dozen other leaders of the Brotherhood, as well as the more radical Jamaa Islamiyah, were also summoned for questioning, reinforcing claims of a security crackdown. Human rights watchdogs and abroad and in Egypt have condemned Monday's killings as a massacre. And finally, Malala Yousafzai, a Pakistani schoolgirl brought to England after being shot in the head by the Taliban, addressed the United Nations, marking her 16th birthday by delivering a speech at the UN headquarters in New York, calling on governments to ensure free compulsory education for every child. The Guardian reports that it was the teenager's first public speech since she was attacked on a bus in Pakistan's northwestern Swat Valley, after standing up for the right to go to school in her home country. Well, that is our news for this week. We'll be right back with T. Nile, followed by our interview today with Bob Ray. Stay tuned. I interviewed Bob Ray. He's a former member of parliament, as well as the former leader of the Liberal Party of Canada, as well as the former premier of Ontario, who crossed over from the NDP to the Liberals several years ago. I spoke to him about his announcement that he was stepping down from politics in order to negotiate on behalf of 9 First Nations in Northern Ontario in their negotiations over the Ring of Fire, a vast mining discovery there, where two companies are vying and claim that there's enough mineral deposits to make the project comparable to the oil sands in terms of revenue. So I asked Bob Ray about his life in politics as well as the importance of the Ring of Fire. Here he is.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Excellent. One thing I wanted to talk about, looking back on your political career, there's been a lot of change in First Nations communities as well as First Nations-Canada relationships. I mean, when you became premier, that was right before the OCA crisis. Could you talk about what's changed and what's not in the decades since you got into power?
Well, I think people have been struggling with the issue of getting other levels of government to recognize the need for inclusion, for recognition, for partnership, for bringing people out of the sense of being marginalized in a lot of communities. Economic activity can happen, but First Nations communities have not benefited. I think there's a lot of studies that show that the stronger the self-government is, the stronger the capacity for making their own decisions is, the the healthier community can become. And I think this is still a struggle. We've come some distance, but we've still got a long way to go. And it's, in my view, it's simply taking too long for provincial and federal governments to wake up for the need for change.
I don't know if you you recall, there was a study that came out of a Southern Ontario military analyst who suggested that there was effectively a simmering resentment that could explode in Aboriginal communities. Do you take that seriously, or do you think that's more fear-mongering?
I certainly think there's a simmering resentment. The terrible irony is that we haven't seen an explosion. We've seen an implosion. We see really appalling rates of suicide. We see very high rates of addiction. We see a lot of family violence. We have a lot of ways in which First Nations people are taking it out on themselves. I do think at some point, looking at historic patterns and cultural patterns around the world, it's quite possible that the resentment could take other forms. But rather than speculate about that, which I don't really like to do, I think we're much wiser to look at the ways in which we have to include people and have to make sure people are able to fully participate in the life of the country.
For a lot of people out here in British Columbia and out west, I don't think people realize the Ring of Fire is such a major issue, but it's been described as the oil sands of Ontario.
Well, I certainly think it is a major mineral find. I mean, it's a very large chromite mine or chromite development that's been discovered. As well as a number of other resources in that area, so there's a lot of talk about how big it is, and people often comparing it to the discovery of nickel in the Sudbury Basin and the discovery of gold there as well. But it's certainly got the word major written all over it.
Mm. Now, you described your leaving politics for the Ring of Fire as a very emotional decision. Why was that?
Well, just that, retiring from Parliament was not an easy thing to do. I enjoyed my life here. I made a comeback into federal politics after being away for a time, and I tried to become the leader, and that didn't work. Became the interim leader, and saw the party doing better. But I also realize that at this point in my life, I've got one or two big mandates left and the big challenges left in terms of my working life, and I very much want to focus on the issues that I think that matter to me. And this is certainly something that matters to me a lot, so I want to be part of it.
Mm. Now, looking back, if the Bob Rae of 10 years ago imagined, could he have imagined you leaving politics to focus on First Nations politics? Is that something?
Oh, yes, that's always been an interest of mine. In fact, it's arguably, if this had come along 10 years ago, I might not have gotten back into politics. It's a very very challenging issue, and it's really pretty critical for. How we do development in Canada. There's, I think, an opportunity to do things in a new way and in a different way, certainly for Ontario. And we'll just have to see whether or not the engagement is really there from the province.
From the First Nations perspective, what are the big challenges facing the Ring of Fire?
Well, I mean, there's a lot. The first one, obviously, is that. This is, the Mattawa Historic Territory is an area as big as France. It's huge. It extends north of Lake Superior, almost to the coast of James Bay. So it's a big territory. it's pristine, it's beautiful, it's lakes and streams and some big rivers, huge rivers, the Albany system and the Attawapiskat system are major water systems in the north of the province. And there's a lot of environmental issues that that flow from this. I mean, it's it potentially can have a very negative impact on the environment, or it can it's an impact that can be assessed and regulated and controlled. We just have to see to what extent the province is and the federal government are prepared to exercise their responsibilities in this regard.
Now, there have been a number of controversies around the mining operations from First Nations, whether it's around the unauthorized use of lands for exploration or around environmental assessments. What's the current status of those concerns from the nine groups that you're working with?
Well, there's still a sense of inadequate consultation on exploration and prospecting. There's a deep concern about the environmental assessment process. It's right now, it's the province has not committed to what we would call an ecosystem review. So there's a lot of concern about the impact of the way in which the impact is being assessed, and that we've taken that the federal government is being subjected to a judicial review at the moment, an application for judicial review of their decision to limit the amount of public participation. And so there's some real questions and issues that we have to sort out as we go forward.
One thing that that strikes me out west is the demand of some of the First Nations to have a seat at the table of the environmental assessment. That's not something that we see very often. And is this something that could have a precedent if that demand continues and is successful elsewhere?
Well, it has its precedence already in Canada. The environmental assessment that was done of the mining development in Baffin Island that's been recently concluded. Was done with full participation in the panel by First Nations communities. I mean, you know, you obviously need to have a panel that's qualified, but you've also got to have a panel that has the confidence of the people whose lives are going to be affected by the development. And I think that's something that's important.
Mm. Well, another issue that I've noticed with the Ring of Fire is the discussion about how First Nations will benefit from the mining if it goes ahead, and those include revenue sharing as well as jobs and skills sharing. It seems like there are some challenges there. Could you talk about those, please?
Yeah, well, the first challenge on jobs and skills is that this is going to take work to get the communities in shape to be able to benefit from the agreements. We have a lot of social and economic issues within the First Nation communities, and the hard fact of the matter is that governments are going to have to commit to doing more in terms of investing in people to ensure that the people actually can benefit from the jobs and opportunities, not only in mining, but in building the infrastructure, improving the infrastructure, making sure that you know, people have access to roads and people have access to electricity and you know, better broadband and better access to the internet. The schools are are isolated communities, and healthcare and access to better healthcare is obviously an issue as well. It's no secret that we have had over the last several years a prescription drug addiction issue in the far north. The chiefs have been addressing it publicly and asking governments to do more to address it. Some steps have been taken, but there's still a long way to go to make sure that we've got the programs in place. I mean, the fact is that people need to be ready for whether it's jobs in the mining sector or the resource sector or other kinds of jobs, people have to be ready for that. And the second is on the resource revenue. I think there's an interest on the part of the province in addressing that question in terms of communities that are impacted by the development. And so I think there will be issues around how the benefits from the development are fairly shared with the people whose lives are most directly affected by the development.
Now, I wanted to ask about, you had a significant role in meeting with Chief Teresa Spence during her hunger strike, and as I understand it, visited her in her tent on Ottawa, and were part of negotiating or dealing with that crisis that happened. Could you offer any reflections about meeting her and about that whole explosion around Idle No More and her strike?
Well, I think that for me it was important to resolve the issue and to give Chief Spence a way of ending the hunger strike in a respectful way. I think that it doesn't do our country any good to see people driven to the point of going on a hunger strike in order to try and make a point. I just don't think that should be the way we do business in Canada. And I've never been one to thought that, you know, having a meeting with the First Minister, the Premier, or the Governor General, or whatever, is a big deal. To me, it's like you find ways of resolving these things, and you find ways of including people, and you find ways of giving an opportunity for discussion. And I felt that if the Prime Minister wasn't prepared to find a way to do that, that the rest of the political system had to do its best.
And what do you make of Prime Minister Harper's response to that situation and the decisions he made around how the meeting was conducted on January 11th, that kind of thing?
Well, I don't think he's helped matters. I think that the reluctance to engage in a government-to-government meeting with First Nations, the reluctance to have a regular series of meetings and a regular and appropriate dialogue with the leadership of the First Nations, I think that reluctance is contributing to the problem, and we have to find the country has to find ways of responding more effectively, and I think it was John McDonald who he was talking about Quebec said treat them like a faction and they'll react like a faction, and you treat people with respect, and you're much more likely to get respect in return. That's, I think, an important part of human experience.
Now, my penultimate question, sir, any regrets from your years in politics now that you're kind of having a chance to look back on it?
Oh, no. I don't look back with any regrets at all. I mean, you just do the best you can in different situations, and I've had a very enjoyable time in parliamentary and legislative politics, and now I'm looking forward to a new chapter.
Well, anything else you'd like to add or about your next steps?
No, I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to have a lot of ups and downs, but I'm sure it'll go well in the end.
Well, I really want to thank you for your time. It's a pleasure.
Thanks
to talk
a lot.
To you.
Nice to talk to you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And that was Bob Ray, former member of Parliament, now moving on to the Ring of Fire negotiations.
We'll be right back with Eugene Bellanger talking about the Dashinta land-based Indigenous school. Stay tuned. You're listening to This Week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca and on the Rabble Podcast Network and on iTunes. Now, for our next interview, Erwin Ostendi interviewed Eugene Bellanger. He is the Director of Strategic Planning for the Deschinta Land-Based Indigenous School in the far north. We found out about what a land-based school is about, as well as some report back from the Tar Sands Healing Walk in northern Alberta. Here's Erwin Ostendi interviewing Eugene Bellanger.
Good morning, Eugene.
Morning, Erwin.
Thanks for joining us. Just prefacing this conversation with the fact that where are you right now?
I'm in the Edmonton Airport, actually.
Okay. So you're in Edmonton heading up north. And maybe just give our listeners a sense of what is Deschinta, just to get the conversation going.
Deschinta is a land-based university in the Northwest Territories, and it focuses on the confluence between Western academic tradition and Indigenous ways of knowing and being. I guess it's a very unique experience, seeing that Canada is the only circumpolar country without a circumpolar university, and Deschinta is about 4 years old. So my role is to grow the organization, to grow the faculty and staff, and to start taking or developing initiatives for Deschinta to undertake in order to achieve some measurable forms of success and growth.
Now, the goal of Deschinta is obviously working with people of the Dene heritage. And is it only for Dene Indigenous people, or is it a cross-cultural program?
Absolutely, it's totally cross-cultural. Most notable pieces of feedback that we get is that this experience is transformational and it's life-changing, and that it's very important that we have a mixture of students on-site so that it facilitates that cross-cultural, it breaks down the barriers between, say, non-Indigenous and Indigenous students and sort of gives each other, it gives everybody a chance to flesh out what the stereotypes are, how to work through them, and to do it as a group and collectivity.
Now, what type of, when we think of a university, we think about classes and education and professors. How is this different? What does a land-based university mean?
Well, students meet in Yellowknife. We'll have students from the Northwest Territories, from the smaller communities, meet in Yellowknife, and sometimes we have students from the south who will come up and meet in the territory's capital. And from there, they get on a bush plane, and we fly them out to a remote location where there's a lodge, and half of their time is spent in classrooms, or sometimes the classrooms can be around a campfire, listening to lectures and doing that pedagogical, being in that type of learning environment. And the other half of their time is spent with the elder professors, and during this time they're learning traditional land-based skills, such as different ways of preparing and drying fish, or one semester students were able to be on site while Elder Moise shot a moose. So they were able to learn how to skin and quarter a moose and how to deal with that. And, at the same time, they're also learning how to tan moose hides and make drums and harvest from that geology. So it's really a mixture. And as well, something that we've started to do recently is to train our students in boat safety, first aid, and firearm certification training, so that when they're finished their semesters, they're more practical and safe people.
What are some of the practical courses? I'm assuming that you talked about different courses. There's also professors that you might find at Southern universities also teaching here. What are some of the courses that they would be teaching?
Well, Glenn Coulthard has developed a course called Dene Self-Determination in Theory and Practice, and that course it looks at the Dene experience and the Dene struggle for self-determination. And it looks at the political history of Dene and Dene, or the Northwest Territories, pulling from Indigenous experts and leading professors and local leaders and elders, and in a very much like a co-teaching environment. This August, we have a short course which he's designed, and we're going to have Leanne Simpson and Stephanie Erlbacher Fox up. And Leanne Simpson is a teacher she's a university professor in Ontario. And Stephanie Erlbacher Fox is a longtime consultant for Aboriginal governments negotiating self-government or land claim in the Northwest Territories. And right now, Deschinta is one course short of a minor, and we're credited to the University of Alberta. And we've also just been passed through the Senate at McGill, so soon students will have the option of either taking our courses through the University of Alberta or through McGill.
Okay.
And most of our courses look at self-government, sustainability, and environmental monitoring.
And how can people learn about that and participate further in terms of a website or following and learning more? I know I actually figured out I was just pushing the wrong button, but the Dushinta Experience is a great video on your website. Are there other ways that you recommend people learning about Dushinta and considering whether this is something that might pique their interest? And in particular, if they're from the north, maybe they would want to come back home and take courses like this.
Absolutely. I think Dushinta is going to be I expect that in the coming year, we'll be taking some initiatives down south to sort of raise the profile of the organization. But in the meantime, people can definitely and should probably pull out their phones right now and check us out on Twitter or DushintaU. And we're also on Facebook at Dushinta University. So those are two ways to keep up to date on the day-to-day happenings of the organization. And people can also check out Dushinta.ca if they're curious about applying or what it takes to get up there.
Okay, and we will follow Dushinta. And switching gears, I know you're in Edmonton, and you were participating, witnessing the healing walk that just took place, the Tar Sands Healing Walk. And maybe mm-hmm. you can just give our listeners a sense of firsthand what your experience was like over the last few days in Northern Alberta.
Yeah, well, I'm just looking at the photos I took and that I put up on my Facebook page, and for me, the purpose of me going was, it was more of a, it came from a very spiritual place personally, as opposed to a networking or maybe like a more professional endeavor. I was definitely wearing my Dene hat, and it was, you know, you try to prepare yourself for it, but really there's nothing you can do to prepare for what you see. And out there, it's just devastating hearing about the process that has created these giant indents in the landscape, and these huge, like enormous lakes that, you know, even though there was wind, the lake doesn't ripple, and it smells like chemicals. And
these are the tar sand tailing ponds, I guess.
Exactly. We walked by the sink. We did a 14-kilometer walk, a loop on the highway, and we were able to walk past one of the sink crude operations, East Mine, which is allegedly a reclamation in progress. And the walk itself, I was really, I guess, comforted or uplifted by the strong sense of community that I felt out there at the campsite and both on the walk, where people are just looking after each other, checking in with each other. Strangers are meeting each other for the first time, and everybody's going through this experience together. But if, you know, some of the easiest things to remember is just the astonishment that if this is Canada's economic driver, then this is something we should all be very ashamed of, and that more people should come out and see firsthand for themselves what it is that the tar sands are and what it looks like. And it really, I think it really hits you on a really deep level.
Mm-hmm.
And well, so, like I said, my purpose in going there was a spiritual one. So I was going to represent Chicago Tene Dene young people and to bear witness to the ceremony that the local First Nations were performing in order to heal the land.
Okay, and we'll be speaking hopefully in a few minutes with Keith Stewart of Greenpeace about his experience as well. So we'll leave it at that, and we're going to go play some audio from the Dushinta video from your website, Dushinta.ca. So appreciate your time, Eugene, and thanks for joining us.
Merci, Joe Irwin.
Okay, good day.
Bye.
And that was Eugene Bellanger, interviewed by Irwin Ostindi. Eugene is the Director of Strategic Planning for Dushinta, a land-based Indigenous school. You can find them at dushinta.ca. We'll be back with Keith Stewart from Greenpeace Canada, talking about the Lac-Mégantic train disaster, as well as the tar sands. Stay tuned. You're listening to This Week on Media Mornings here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, and online at w2media.ca. You can also find us on the Rabble Podcast Network and on iTunes. Now, our next interview today is with Keith Stewart. He's Climate and Energy Coordinator with Greenpeace Canada and was also interviewed by Irwin Ostindi on our program.
Good morning, Keith.
Good Good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Media Mornings. And what's let's just start with the healing walk. The tar sands healing walk is an opportunity for people to gather in, shall we say, the belly of the beast. But it's also impacted Indigenous territory. And maybe just give us a sense of your experience of participating in the healing walk, your first-person experience.
Well, this is actually my first time to the tar sands. I've been sort of researching them and talking about them for many years. But this is the first time I've been to the belly of that beast. And the thing that really hits you is the scale, just how big everything is, how big the equipment is, how big the tailings ponds are. And just it kind of gets right into your skin and in your nose because it smells. I mean, like, it smells toxic. You sort of get the grit coming off of the sort of some of the mines, and it's really kind of overwhelming. And it was fascinating for me to be there. You know, this wasn't a traditional demonstration, the kind of thing I go to a lot. This was an actual healing walk. We sort of spent, I guess, 6 or 8 hours sort of walking that route, and then stopping every once in a while, stopping for ceremony. Talking with people, and I think it's, you know, it was kind of overwhelming in some senses, but on the other hand, I'm really glad I did it and had that opportunity to share with other people and sort of back at the camp and around the tents and the campfires. I'm glad I'm there, and I went there, but I'm glad I'm not there right now.
Yeah. Now, one of your coworkers, Melina Laboucan, she's one of the organizers of that, and she works with Greenpeace. Maybe just talk a little bit about the experience of being in Alberta in such a contested area, and your experience of meeting people, and particularly Indigenous people like Melina, who carry this because it's also their home territory.
Yeah, so I'm based out of Toronto. I want to fight the tar sands because I view it as one of the great threats to our future. It's sort of the fastest rising source of greenhouse gas emissions, enormous source of toxics, etc. It's kind of like I know those kinds of things because I've read at them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you talk to my colleague Melina, or also Mike, who are both based in Alberta, for them it's not an intellectual thing, it's just part of who they are. Melina's home community, Little Buffalo, is completely surrounded by tar sands operations. There's been something, I think, $14 billion worth of oil taken out of her community's traditional territories, and yet they don't even have drinking water. They don't even have running water. And it was also, the Little Buffalo was the site of one of the largest spills in Alberta's history back in 2011. They really are sort of coming at it from a place coming from their heart, and it's sort of inspiring to work with them and work with sort of the other, sort of that whole community that's in Alberta fighting it there, which is not an easy thing to do. It's not an easy thing to stand up and say, you know, there's a problem with the tar sands in Alberta.
Now, just give us, we're going to talk about Lac Mégantic in a second, but what was the story of another spill that was reported in Alberta?
So this is, we don't really know right now. While the healing walk was going on, community members started calling Chief Alan Adam of the Athabasca Chippewyan First Nation, saying, hey, there's oil in the water. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they detected sort of, you know, people sort of 5 kilometers along the river were sort of saying they were spotting it. They went out and started taking pictures. Mm-hmm. Chief Adam actually left the healing walk early to go, and he actually flew over to try and get a scent of it. And, you know, when he saw it, it was 100 kilometers of the river had some kind of an oil sheen on it, or some kind of a sheen that looked like oil. We don't know what it was. All the operators say that they don't have a leak. The provincial government said, we sent someone to look and they didn't see anything, which is kind of surprising because I've seen the pictures and it's pretty clear what's there. So we're still waiting on word on what it is. It might be a new spill. It might have been actually sort of, there's a spill from an Enbridge pipeline a couple of weeks back that might have, you know, somehow got into the water now. It's just not clear. And Alberta is supposed to have this, you know, world-class monitoring system, and what we're seeing time and time again is it's community members who are identifying these spills and the government saying, like, what? And sort of only reacting after people are raising the alarm.
Now, as you did, we woke up on Saturday morning to the news of a very, very devastating impact on a Quebec town, Lac Mégantic, which will probably in the end suffer dozens of deaths from the issue of oil transport. There has been a marked increase, and I think marked is an understatement, a massive increase in the transport of oil via rail over the last few years, and just in the last handful of years. And, you know, from your experience with Greenpeace and looking at the transport of oil across Canada and the fact that you've been now to the tar sands, you know, the tar sands and oil production in general requires export, and it requires pipelines like Enbridge and Kinder Morgan and XL, Keystone XL, and it requires rail transport. And a lot of the efforts of activists and Indigenous communities is to say, stop the transport, stop the oil from getting out of Alberta. And I'm just curious about your understanding of how does rail transport factor into this issue of exporting and getting oil out of Alberta?
So what we've been saying for a long time is we need to get off oil. And, you know, we know we're not going to shut it down all tomorrow, but when we make a new investment, when we build something new and spend the resources to do that, it should be clean energy, not more dirty energy. But what we're seeing in the tar sands is incredibly rapid expansion. It's basically doubled in the last 10 years. They're talking about tripling it in the next 10 years. It's, as I said, the fastest rising source of greenhouse gas emissions. And it's currently about 2 million barrels per day, and there's actually 5 million barrels per day worth of production that's got all of its approvals in place and or is under construction. And then there's proposals to actually take that all the way up to 9 million barrels per day, like sort of a quadrupling of current production. So the only way you can do that type of expansion is by building new infrastructure to move that oil out, whether it's pipelines or whether it's rail. We've had success in delaying their pipeline expansions, and that's actually resulted in projects being delayed in the tar sands. This is having a direct impact. You know, you basically limit the export capacity by working, you know, as part of broad movements to sort of stop those things like the Northern Gateway pipeline and sort of similar mobilization happening now against Kinder Morgan. But part of what they try to do is respond by moving by rail. And rail will never be able to carry as much as pipelines. It's just, I mean, we've seen a massive increase in rail transport in the last 3 years. There basically was no oil moving by rail 4 years ago. It's currently about 2% of, in 2012, 2% of oil exports were by rail from Canada. So 2%, you know, that's not a lot in terms of the big picture, but it's a lot to move by rail. And they're looking at trying to double that again in 2013. So increasing rapidly. One of our big concerns is, well, obviously, this, you know, there's sort of all sorts of safety problems that go along with that. But in particular, Federal Transportation Safety Board has, Canadian Transportation Safety Board has said over and over again to the federal government, you know, the older type of cars that are used to transport the vast majority of oil are unsafe. When they derail, they tend to rupture very easily. They spill the oil, and you have a real risk of fire and explosion when that happens, because when you derail, you've got all kinds of sparks happening. So what we're seeing is a real danger there, and we want to get off of oil as quickly as possible and clean that up. So we think they should stop using those cars right now as part of a transition off of oil. You sort of have to be doing both at the same time.
And what's the traction been at, you know, Lac Mégantic, the story now looks to be whether a locomotive was tampered with, whether the engine was shut off. And that's looking at the kind of technical aspect of rail safety. Is there much traction in the media? Are you getting phone calls from the media about this issue of, you know, how oil is being transported, period, not just whether, you know, a locomotive was turned off or on is really the issue?
Yeah, I am getting a lot of calls yesterday and today.
And that was Keith Stewart, Climate and Energy Coordinator with Greenpeace Canada, interviewed by Erwin Ostindy. We have on the line with us Crawford Killian. He's a writer at thetai.ca. He's published 21 books, both fiction and nonfiction, as well as hundreds of articles. He wrote an article in the Tai that was republished in the Toronto Star called Corporal Horton versus the Harper Government, alleging that one Mountie's attempt to get to the bottom of the Mike Duffy scandal could be the biggest challenge for Prime Minister Harper yet. Good morning, Crawford.
Good morning.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thanks.
Well, thanks so much for rising early to speak with our listeners. Who is Corporal Horton?
Corporal Horton is Greg Horton, who is an old RCMP veteran in the national branch, which means he's not just ticketing speeders in the suburbs. He's dealing with issues that affect, as he says, the integrity of the country. And he evidently runs his own little shop in Ottawa, and he took it on himself after the media reports of the Duffy business began to surface, to start looking into it. And his affidavit is largely based on the chronology he developed from those media reports. And what his affidavit is seeking is access to more information, which would get well beyond simply what the newspapers know.
Now, so far, the Senate expense scandal has been described in the media as kind of ethical oversight, or, you know, did Nigel Wright cut this $90,000 check out of altruism, or was he ordered to do it? But, you know, it seems to be having some traction. But RCMP Corporal Horton is actually alleging some criminal activity here. What is he alleging?
Well, he's talking about two particular problems. One is a breach of trust is one, and frauds against government is the other. And the breach of trust refers to partly what Duffy was claiming for his Ottawa house allowance when he was really not entitled to, as well as charging the Senate his per diem expenses when, in fact, he was off either on holiday or campaigning for the Conservatives in the 2011 election. And the frauds on government relate to the $90,000 check from Nigel Wright. So right there, we are looking at some pretty serious crimes. And what the affidavit is demonstrating is that he has enough evidence to warrant going further.
One thing that they revealed was that, in fact, several people in the Prime Minister's office discussed this issue. It was not, as Stephen Harper said, a private matter between Wright and Duffy.
Yes, and this is one of the helpful things about the affidavit and its chronology of events, is that it helps the reader who is now trying to get a sense of this to see the sequence of events, and then you can begin to apply what you recall from watching the news or reading papers or whatever about, oh yes. And one of the things that struck me was that when you look back on this whole thing, the Conservatives, whether from Harper on down, were essentially conducting a fighting retreat. And, you know, that they didn't know this or they didn't know that, or Senator Duffy has done the honorable thing and he showed leadership by paying off the $90,000. And then when that was revealed not to have been his money in the first place, then Nigel Wright had done the honorable thing in saving the taxpayers from a non-existent threat. It wasn't as if somehow, they were just going to write off the $90,000 and let Duffy go more or less free. So obviously that seems to me to indicate that they knew what was going on and were simply trying to drag things out, keep it going as long as possible, while denying as much as possible, in the hopes that eventually it would fizzle out and they could carry on.
Now, this isn't the first scandal the government has faced. I mean, whether we're talking about the prorogation of parliament, the Afghanistan torture issue. Yeah. Why do you think, however, that this is the threat that Harper's government may not survive?
Because he is so deeply involved in it, and his own office is involved in it. This is not just something he can write off as not really that big a deal, not affecting him. He appointed everyone in the PMO. He appointed these senators who are now bringing disrepute to the Senate, and so forth. So without Stephen Harper, really none of this would have happened.
What's it going to take for this to continue to go up the ladder and potentially put a dent on the government?
I'm not sure, but obviously if he thinks that he can get more material, and he does, and that becomes useful, then we are probably going to get an outright charge, and possibly charges on several people. It seems to me that Nigel Wright is very likely to be charged. It also seems to me at least worth speculating that the reason why Nigel Wright was willing to write this personal check was that he told Duffy, stop talking to the media about this. I'll give you the money, put it in the bank and pay it off at once, and then stop talking about this. And it seems to me that Duffy may know a whole lot more than he has revealed so far. And that is what, his silence is what is getting, what is of concern to the Conservative Party now.
Well, maybe one last question, Crawford.
Sure.
A lot of the previous scandals have been dismissed by Conservative supporters as being ideologically driven, such as the robocall scandal, for instance. In this case, corruption allegations are at the heart of the Conservative Party's own base in terms of their idea of bringing in transparency and accountability. Is that something that's going to factor into how much this will hurt the government?
I think one of the areas where it's going to hurt the government most is that this was what really Stephen Harper campaigned on as a reformer for many years, which was reforming the Senate, getting rid of all that dead weight and so forth. And instead, he has created a monstrous parody of his own version of the Senate.
Well, that's a great phrase to end up on. Thank you so much for your time, Crawford. Greatly appreciated. Crawford Killian, writer with the Tai.ca.
Well, that's our program for this week on Media Mornings. Thank you for listening. You can find us on Rabble Podcast Network, on iTunes, as well as live streamed on our website at w2media.ca. Thank you so much for listening.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at W2Media.ca.